So it's not going to be like ATP where you spend the first hour talking about your Mac Pro, is it?
I've been playing Batman on it. That's been fun. No, I'm done. That's all I got to say about it.
Joe, is there a particular company you want us to plug you as being from? Or is...
No, I'm unattached. So...
Can I just call you Joe Hewitt, Gardener at Large?
Sure. Anything works. I actually changed my LinkedIn. I got tired of getting job offers from LinkedIn, so I changed my career to gardener up there, and they stopped magically.
Awesome.
Yeah, no more job offers.
Although I bet a bunch of people tried to see if there was a new startup called gardening on the Valley.
Yes, there probably are.
It's not cloud-based. It's soil-based. It's going to be this.
Yeah.
Joe, I'm most familiar with you from the Facebook for iPhone app, which I think is the most popular iPhone app in the history of the universe, if not creation. But I'm sure that's not where you first touched a computer.
No, it was not, for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I've been, I got my dad got our first family computer when I was 7, a few years before the iPhone SDK came out. So, yeah, I learned to program at a fairly young age. It's funny, there was all that stuff in the news a couple weeks ago about Paul Graham talking about how, you know, girls, young girls don't learn, you know, or he thought young girls weren't learning to code when they were young. And I was thinking, man, he's talking about how, you know, kids at a young age learn to program and that gives them an advantage. And I never really thought of it as an advantage as much coming up, but I guess I really did, you know, have the fortunate situation of learning to code when I was, you know, my age was in the single digits, because my dad was trying to learn to program to potentially change careers. He was, an engineer of machines, and he was teaching himself to program in the 80s, and I just sort of globbed on. And it's funny, we used to type in these long code samples for magazines. Do you guys remember those days when the magazines?
Yeah, that's how I got my start too.
I had an IBM PC Junior, actually, which I didn't know at the time. Now I know it was considered a really terrible computer, but you know, we didn't. I didn't know any better when I was, you know, 7 or 8. Yeah. But I learned to program via BASIC, you know, pretty much the language of the day. And later on learned Turbo Pascal and was programming, you know, on Windows for a long time. I didn't actually switch over to Apple's platforms until 2004 or so, when OS X started to mature.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what was your first program? Do you remember?
Gosh, I remember just in the beginning that mostly what I would do is, you know, type in these programs and then change them, which was really exciting. You know, you'd have these games, then you'd, you know, make little minor changes. And it was just so incredible as a kid. Even now people ask me how to, you know, learn programming. I'm like, you know, just like learn to compile something and then change it. And if you're not like blown away by what you can do without any programming skills, then, you know, maybe programming is not for you. But later on,
Changing like the little O character into a zero or something. Like,
anything. Just seeing that you can do it, because especially if you've been playing video games on consoles like I was before I got a computer, you know, where you can't change anything, you know, mm-hmm. with cartridge or now, you know, disc based games, you know, having that ability to change stuff is pretty exciting. So then later on, I did. Start writing some pretty, you know, stupid games. There was like, I remember a Jeopardy type game, you know, like a quiz game. And I used to write all these database things to, you know, enter in all of my baseball card collections and CD collections and things like that. That was fun. Nothing really mind blowing, you know, before the web. And then when the web came about, that really is when things started getting fun.
So yeah, you started writing, well, native PC software, right? So
yeah,
what about the web intrigued you? Because it's kind of a different thing. And in the, you know, the early 90s or mid 90s, mm-hmm. when it was getting started, writing HTML didn't really feel like programming so much as, well, doing markup, right? It's a different
thing.
For
sure. Yeah. Yeah, when I first I remember the first web page I ever made was for the Lynx browser. You know, it was a text-based browser. So I started, you know, I discovered the web via BBSs. There was a local BBS, you know, dial-up BBS in my area that it's in like 1993 yeah. that had access to the internet.
Did you play a lot of Trade Wars?
Trade Wars? I don't remember that one.
It was one of those BBS games I just sank like an alternative life into. I just spent way too much time doing that.
Oh, I'm glad I didn't find that one then.
Yeah. BBS is pretty
cool. Yeah, they were.
But
they
this
were.
One had a. This one could bridge to the internet.
Yeah, there was one run by some local library that had internet access, and that was incredible. I remember, you know, basically spending all of my time searching for JPEGs. That was amazing. Being able to because you would download these JPEGs. You couldn't view them in the browser, right? Because it was text-based. But you could download them and look at them, you know, on your 256 color display, which was just rocked my world.
Were they like all UU encoded or something?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. that was pretty exciting. Then that was on Windows 3.1. And then later on, you know, I think I got a 56K modem, and then that was pretty exciting. And then I was able to get a, the first visual, browser, the first, browser, I think I got it. It was Spyglass or something. It wasn't Mosaic.
Spyglass. That just for the audience, I went on to become Internet Explorer.
Yeah. It was something through Prodigy. I can't remember exactly. I didn't use it for long before I discovered Netscape 1.0. Right. And at the time there was no JavaScript, there was no CSS. It was just, you know, crappy HTML. So I made a web page for myself, hosted on my local ISP. And then I got really excited about just every markup tag because, you know, mm-hmm. just all the different layout possibilities were, you know, that was all the freedom you had. And it's funny, I think about it, I was actually starting to become a serious programmer before the web. Like I was programming in C, and I was starting to learn a little assembly and doing like graphics programming. And then I like forgot all about that because of this stupid little markup language that, you know, basically rotted my brain. There was not a lot you can do, but just being able to put something on the web and have people find it was like a drug. And then I just started eating up all of the, every time Netscape would come out with a new release, you know, they were really rapidly expanding the platform. Yeah. And eventually JavaScript came around, and you know, and then every time there was a new JavaScript API, I was just eating it up and putting, you know, all these experiments out on my website. And, you know, back then I was in high school or just out of high school, and I really didn't take college all that seriously because I was just so into programming for fun. Eventually people started paying me to do it. So I never really needed to finish college, and I didn't just because the money and the jobs were just so much, they were just coming at me.
It's not a bad position to be in.
No.
So was it JavaScript that really hooked you, or like when did CGIs come in?
Pearl.
Pretty early,
Pearl,
right?
Yeah, that was for sure. Yeah. I think I was working on a lot of Perl stuff at the same time. I started developing websites for clients for money, like just local business stuff, and learning CGI scripts for managing, you know, forms and little bits of database they were collecting, stuff like that. Nothing mind blowing. Perl was probably, I probably wrote more Perl than JavaScript for a while there. I haven't written Perl in probably 20 years now, though. I don't miss it.
Yeah. So eventually you get sort of wrapped up in working on Firefox, right? Down the line, or is that like?
Yeah, I was, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I was living in New Jersey with my parents basically. And, I got a job, at a company that, have you ever heard of, the Elder Scrolls game?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I got a job not for a company that owned Bethesda Softworks, a company called ZeniMax. They were this during the first .com boom. They, you know, spun out this lab that was, you know, had all these ambitious goals for crazy web platform stuff they were going to do. And I got a job for them developing a JavaScript library. Just like basically, there was, do you guys ever remember in the late 90s, there were a couple companies trying to do these web operating system type things.
Yes.
There's one called WebOS.
Yes.
So there were a couple, I forget the other one, desktop.com, I think it was called.
Yeah. And WebOS, not the
Palm one.
The Palm one. Right.
It's been done before. Yeah. I mean, Netscape was huge into that, right? And that's kind of why Microsoft got spooked a bit.
Yeah. They were, well, the, The Netscape, yeah, Netscape was building a lot of stuff into the browser. And then there were a few of these companies that were trying to basically replicate the windowing system in JavaScript, which we've, you know, we've all seen a million times done now. But back then it was like, wow, you can do that. So they'd have all like a desktop with a word processors. And so, I wound up working for this lab that was decided they wanted to get into that game too. So I was building all these JavaScript controls for, you know, windowing, stuff.
Is that fun? I mean, you're doing your own UI kit, right?
Yeah, basically it was a UI kit, and you know, nowadays, you know, oh yay, another stupid, you know, UI kit in JavaScript there. But back then it was pretty exciting to work on that. Yeah. But the .com boom came to an end and that company dissolved, and I had started to play around with the Mozilla open source project, and wound up getting hired by Netscape, moved out to California to work on the actual browser team doing the front end for the browser, which itself was written in JavaScript and CSS and still is, actually.
Yeah, it's Zool, right? XUL?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So what is that? That's like a mix of markup and JavaScript kind of thing? Or like,
yeah,
what makes Zool different than just regular HTML and CSS and all that jank?
Zool was really ahead of its time. A lot of the stuff that was pioneered in Zool and related technologies has made its way into HTML5 over the years. There were basically a bunch of tags for your typical desktop windowing controls, you know, drop downs and things like that, buttons and all the different stuff. And, so that basically all the entire window was a markup language describing all the different controls. It was just like HTML with different tags. And it also had this system called XBL, which, has now been, iterated and refined and baked into HTML5. I forget what they call it now. Basically you can write your own tags and you can have a encapsulation of all the interactions and styles inside that tag. And so that's how we did all the different controls. So I started out doing that, and then I started, because I had a background writing C and C++, so I eventually started working on the actual browser engine and the Zool engine.
And so the Zool would be rendered with its own renderer, like with native controls, rather than going through the HTML renderer?
This is a big controversy back in the day, because there was a faction that wanted the browser, the Netscape Mozilla browser, to be, you know, done in native controls. And then there was the Zool guys who, because Netscape had to ship on Mac, Windows, and Linux, they wanted to do everything cross-platform at the front-end level. It was a decision they made that basically killed the project. I mean, it set them back. There were a lot of rewrites that happened to that project that really set them back and gave Microsoft the lead that they never relinquished, and ultimately led to what became Firefox, because the project had to be rebooted.
Right.
The front end being cross-platform and it being such a major project made a lot of things easier, because you didn't have to do things three times, but you actually did have to do them three times, because you had to imitate the three different operating systems in CSS. So it was like, there was one level of the implementation, which was uniform across all operating systems. And then there was a level above it, which had to be redone over and over.
Yeah. That's kind of the way that these kits go in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, that's still how they do it to this day in Firefox. There was actually there were a group of people that started inside the project that started writing native browsers. You might remember Camino, which just was retired. Yep. Started out as what was it called, Chimera, I think, in the beginning. That was
it was a Cocoa web browser.
Yeah, that was Dave Hyatt's idea, and there was another guy who did a Windows native browser. I don't know if anyone did a Linux native browser, but those started up, and you know, eventually those, you know, they. I'm surprised actually that Firefox has maintained that cross-platform UI all these years.
Yeah, there's competing interests, right? Because some people only live in one platform, want every app to look like that platform, and some people live in the browser and want that browser to look the same no matter what platform they're on.
Yeah, mm-hmm, exactly. And you know, as we see, you know, there are a lot of native, you know, people can take that opportunity to rewrite things that are in cross-platform form, you know, in native form, and have some success, because there are just a large faction of people that look at a cross-platform app and they immediately spot the things that just aren't right, that are just slightly different from the native toolkit or work slightly different, and that just ruins the whole thing for them. So that's really a minority. It's sort of Firefox proves that the success it had. You know, most people don't notice that stuff, but there's just enough people that do that open the door for Safari and things like that.
Right. So you didn't get into the Mac until about, you know, 2004-ish, you said. Were you still a Windows guy this whole time, or were you getting into really?
Yeah. Sorry. I know. You know, my dad, it's all my dad's fault. I remember when I was when I was seven and he was debating getting a Windows computer or an Apple computer. I guess, I don't know if it was going to be a Mac or whatever the Apple pre-Mac was at that time in 1985. But yeah, he went Windows and that got, or yes, not Windows, DOS. He went DOS, and that kept me on Microsoft platforms until I got at Netscape. I got a, everyone had to develop for three platforms. So I got a Mac for work. It was a titanium PowerBook. It was an amazing laptop compared to the Windows laptops of the time. If you remember those, they were very thin. Actually, the PowerBooks got much thicker after that model.
And, yeah, they were good, the original ones. The titanium ones are awesome to look at.
They're beautiful. I still have mine. And I'm like, how do they get, they started getting actually like thicker and heavier after that one for some reason. That was a great computer. I fell in love with OS X and gosh, I was thinking about today, like the way iOS 7 just, you know, had that massive, overhaul of the aesthetic, thinking about how different my perception of those changes were compared to the way I felt about the way OS X went, you know, completely overhauling the UI and going with that candy, you know, lickable candy look, just made me feel so like excited about the platform. And I had never, you know, really liked OS 9 or prior. Didn't really get me. I was one of those people that would argue over why Windows was better than Macs.
Yeah, and I never got into classic Mac either. I did. Well, I bought like a Power, what are they called? Power Mac G3 when Apple bought Next. And they said they'd have like Rhapsody out in like a year. So I ended up with a Power Mac G3 that just ran classic OS and like Mac OS.
Really?
Never really ran anything from Next. So I kind of got into it, but there's, I don't know. I mean, there's the visceral feeling to it, which I think a lot of old Mac heads kind of get, but the software itself is kind of janky. Like the way that you, you know, if you try to scroll, then your download stops because it's all like, there's no multiprocessing at all without these crazy apps. The way that you have to assign memory, like you have to assign like how much memory an app can use. That's fucking crazy. That's just crazy. That shouldn't happen. Anyway, yeah. So I don't blame you at all. Like for until OS X, going anywhere near a Mac, if you're doing web development stuff, is probably kind of crazy.
And arguably Windows 95, 98, NT 2000 was the most interesting time to play around with that stuff anyway.
It was a great, there was a lot of interesting stuff going on. You know, Microsoft's UI, their front end stuff was always very uninspiring, but as a developer, their developer tools were great. You know, Visual Studio was always a great tool. They were constantly coming out with interesting new APIs, even though the original Win32 API didn't really change much. It was kind of crappy, but it was great. It was really fun working on their platforms in those days. But once I saw OS X, there was no going back. You know, shortly after getting that titanium PowerBook from work, I bought my own PowerBook and, just completely stopped Windows. It was actually cold turkey. I mean, I just realized like a few years later, my gosh, I haven't actually used Windows even once for a second in years. And to this day, like all this stuff going on Microsoft platforms, Vista, from Vista all the way up to now, I just haven't even, touched it. Yeah. But every once in a while, I'll run an emulator for testing something on the web, but I don't miss it.
Yeah, do you feel like, I feel like I should check in because maybe they're doing cool stuff and I just haven't seen for like almost a decade.
I know. Yeah. Well, they really blew it for me back during the pre-Vista. Remember, Vista was called Longhorn. That was their code name for it. And they were doing all these really ambitious things.
WinFS.
WinFS. And they had, what was their front end thing? It was called Arrow later on, but, they had something very similar to Zool. It was a XML markup language for all the front end stuff. And it was very powerful. And they actually did ship that, but it didn't wind up becoming the standard way of building front ends on Windows.
Yeah, I wish I could remember the name of that because that was ambitious. It was kind of a neat idea. It was almost like Apple's Nibs, but like not like they had a tool that you could lay stuff out with, right? And you would describe the relationship between controls a little bit like Arduino layout.
Yeah, there was a different name for the language that they had, the XML dialect, but it was very exciting, and I was really looking forward to working with it. And actually, I was sort of competing with it because I wound up, as the Netscape started becoming a ghost, I was so into Zool that I felt that the project was going in a bad direction. So I started my own Zool-based language, based on the idea of Zool, but a new XML-based system for describing user interfaces, and wound up leaving the browser project at AOL and got AOL to actually let me work on that for about a year. So when all of the Netscape browser people got either laid off or moved on to the Mozilla Foundation, I stayed at AOL and worked on this system. Eventually became used for the AOL Instant Messenger and ICQ applications for building all their, it was cross-platform. So they used that. And so as Microsoft was doing their thing, I was doing my thing. And unfortunately, AOL never really open sourced it, although they talked about doing that. It was called Boxley. And, that led me to eventually quit AOL in frustration head out and into startup land.
So what happened to Netscape from the inside?
Well, basically, they were struggling to figure out how to make money from the browser for a very long time. And after they open sourced it, the ideas started getting really stupid. Like, they just started getting desperate. Like they had in the file menu, you'd have file print and then file print plus. Print plus was a service, you know, for printing physical things through and getting them mailed to you. And they would just start baking all this crap into the browser. And those of us who worked on the browser were really passionate about it, just hated seeing the company bog the UI down with garbage like that. And so it got to a point where AOL decided they were going to let us go, but they didn't do it right away. What they did was they sent out a message to everyone saying, basically, do whatever you want while we figure this out. And our managers all told us, yeah, think of just work on crazy stuff. Think of whatever crazy thing you can do. And this went on for several months. And that was during that time, a group of us, Dave Hyatt and Blake Ross and a few other people basically were like, well, okay, screw this. We're going to fork the entire project and start over with just the stuff that's good and get rid of the crap. Mm-hmm. And then that became independent. And when Mozilla was spun out by AOL as a separate foundation, that fork that Dave and Blake had created continued independently. And Mozilla was originally just going to continue with the source that they had been working on for years. But I think a few years later, they came to their senses, and Firefox, which had been called Phoenix and then was called, I forget what it was called after that, but they adopted that as their main browser. But Netscape, if they hadn't, I don't know, if they hadn't told all the engineers to just basically goof off for 2 months.
100% time.
Yeah. It was really funny. The Wired magazine did a cover story when Firefox 1.0 launched in, I think it was 2005 or 2004. And, they spun the story of Firefox's birth as one of, you know, David and Goliath with, you know, all these young upstart engineers wanting to take down Microsoft. And that wasn't, you know, that story really annoyed me because that was not even close to like anyone's agenda at the time. Like Microsoft was just so far ahead. We were all, a lot of us came to the project with a lot of big goals because Netscape was on top of the world when it was open sourced. It really was the subject of a lot of excitement. And those of us who joined the project and then watched it wither away, you know, had this feeling of wanting so badly to like realize that potential. And, beating
well, even the name, enough. Even like Phoenix is kind of a, just the name sort of says, well, we're going to reboot this
Yeah,
exactly. It's more of like an introspective rather than like, let's go get Microsoft sort of name, right?
Exactly. Exactly. That was exactly the idea. I remember in particular, a bunch of us used to go to Denny's every night at like 1 a.m. after work. that was a tradition. I remember one drive going back to the office from Denny's, and one guy was talking about how his relatives would always say to him, "Man, like, what's going on with that Netscape? Are you guys ever going to ship something?" And he was just so embarrassed and so ashamed. And like, it wasn't a lot of people, you know, were really emotionally attached to the project. So having the opportunity to, you know, be free of all the other engineers we didn't really like working with and the management telling us crap to do, that was, that was the genesis of it.
So Firefox, who ran that? Like, that was totally independent?
Yeah, it was just a an open source fork. It started out, Dave Hyatt.
Netscape didn't mind. Legally, I'm not sure they can.
It was open source, so anyone could do anything they wanted. We forked the project and deleted a bunch of crap and started rewriting parts of it.
AOL didn't mind. It's like, well, our engineers are actually spending their time doing this fork rather than working on.
Like I said, by the time that happened, management knew they were going to lay everyone off.
Okay.
So they didn't care.
Okay.
Who did care were the people who, in the open source community, who invested a lot of time in Mozilla and whose code was being deleted and rewritten by these people who seemed to not have a lot of respect for the history of the project. Those were really the enemies initially. And it took a while. It took a couple of years for the tide to turn and for those voices to eventually fade away. And people looked at Phoenix as a better version. That took a while. But AOL didn't care. The project initially was, Dave Hyatt and Blake Ross and a guy named Ben Goodger, who Dave went on to work at Apple on Safari. Ben went on to work at Google on Chrome. And Blake and I later did a startup together and went to Facebook. So the original people who worked on it all kind of moved on, and then the main Mozilla organization inherited it and took it over.
What's your what browser do you use day to day?
I stopped using Firefox a long time ago.
I'm not trying to get you in like political hot water or anything. I'm just curious.
I use Chrome right now. I used Safari for a while. I use Chrome now. I'm not particularly excited about any of the browsers. Like, Chrome is fine on Mac, but I use it on iOS only because it syncs bookmarks and other things like that, which I like, but it's otherwise kind of a crashy and actually all, I don't know, this is actually something I've been wondering. I have to ask you guys, like, do you guys notice on iOS 7 that all browsers, whether it be Chrome or Safari, just like crash with remarkable frequency?
Yeah. Do you have a 5S?
No, I have I've this phenomenon happens on a 5, an iPad Air, and an iPad Retina Mini, all new, except for the 5. Old devices, new devices. I can't browse for more than 10 minutes without a crash.
Really? I've experienced more crashes on iOS 7, but I've been chalking them up to, well, A, it's a big reboot, and B, 64-bit stuff. But every 10 minutes, that's crazy.
Yeah, my Safari doesn't crash at all, but I do have other apps that get me to respring way more than they should.
I tried I typically use Chrome, but I switched to Safari to try to stop with the crashes, and it crashes too. You know, I tend to keep a lot of tabs open on the iPads especially. But it's just crazy. Like, wow, crash, crash, crash. I don't hear anyone else complaining about this. But because it happens on different devices of mine, I feel like it's not, you know, specific to any configuration or anything.
I've heard a few people complain about it, not many, but I've heard almost everyone complain about the respring or backspring, whatever it is, crashes just in general.
You mean like the when it runs out of memory and just goes back to the home screen?
I don't know the technical terms. Maybe Guy does, but I just get the app. Like, it doesn't reboot, doesn't restart anything. Yeah. I don't have to re-authenticate Touch ID, but the Apple logo comes up, and then it takes a few seconds, and everything's back.
The Windows server gets nuked, and it comes back up.
I'm not talking about where it goes to the Apple logo, where the whole OS crashes. I'm just talking about where the browser
just dies goes
and,
away. Yeah.
And I'm assuming there's some memory leak and it's running out of memory. And that's why the application's being killed. I don't know. Maybe I'm just unlucky.
I don't know. If we were technical people, we could figure this out.
Yeah. I'm just waiting. I keep waiting for the next point release to fix it. And so far it hasn't happened. We got 7.1 coming up soon. So we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. So let's talk about the startup that you did. You got out of, were you disenchanted with Firefox after a bit, or you just wanted to do something new or what?
Like I was telling you about how I started working on a user interface framework, a C-based user interface framework that AOL inherited. That I only worked on the Firefox project for a couple months before I went off and did that. Mm-hmm. So I did that and became disenchanted with AOL. But by then I had already broken away from the browser, the Mozilla browser stuff. So I did that for a while, then I left, and it was funny. I was actually laid off by AOL when they announced the big layoff and they spun up Mozilla Foundation. They called us all into a room and told us we were laid off, and I was called into that room and laid off, even though I wasn't working on the browser anymore. And they, the next day, a colleague of mine on the East Coast and at the AOL headquarters had to go and like beg for them to give me my job back, which they did. So I continued working at AOL for some time, and then when they basically messed up my project, I felt stupid that I had taken my job back and wished that I had, you know, open sourced it or started up a startup or something like that. So I quit and I actually took a job for 8 months, saved some money, and then I quit that. And then Blake and I got together and decided to do an actual startup, which we worked on for about two and a half years. I basically lived off my savings until they just about ran out. And then we raised some money from investors, and we were very coy about what we were working on during that time period, largely because we didn't even know what we were working on ourselves. It was the genesis of the startup was twofold. One, it was me having been frustrated by what I had done at AOL and had to leave behind at AOL and wanting to continue working on that. These are largely UI framework type of things, programming language type of things. Not exactly money-making ideas. Right. And the other one was Blake having just been labeled the cover boy for Firefox, been on every major magazine and newspaper as this boy wonder, watched Firefox explode in popularity and didn't make a dime and felt like he too had kind of given away something of value. And meanwhile, all these venture capital people had seen Blake's name all over the media and started asking him if he wanted to please take a few million dollars of their money. So we got together and we're like, let's take some of that money and have some fun, build a startup and see what we can build. We didn't know what we wanted to build initially. We spent 2 years. Eventually we settled on this, concept, which actually could have worked out if we had kept going with it. The idea was that, again, think back 2004, 2005 timeframe, pre-iPhone. We wanted to deal with, the problem of syncing, your photo collection, from your desktop into the cloud. So our approach was that, so, you know, you'd have your big library on your desktop and we would sync the data, but we'd also have we wanted to deal with the problem of being offline in this clever way in which you would, write applications. In this case, our first application being the photo browsing application, kind of an iPhoto like app. You'd write it in this language, in this web-based language, and then, it would magically run on a server. The same code would run on a server, so you could access it when you were online. So the idea was you would write the app once and it would run both as a local app with offline, or it would run on a server, and the data would be synchronized both ways. And that was our way of dealing with that problem. Again, before smartphones, before Dropbox. Actually, I think if we kept going with it, we may have wound up with something like Dropbox. Mm-hmm. But because, for a variety of reasons, after working on this for 2 years and raising some money, after we raised the money, we didn't even get around to spending a dime of it or hiring anyone when Blake and Mark Zuckerberg became friends, and Zuckerberg started trying to get us to join Facebook. And we said no for a while. And finally, after maybe a few startup frustrations started to build up, we said, yeah, we said, okay, what the hell? Uh-huh.
Was that weird for you? I mean, I guess you hadn't shipped anything, right? So you didn't have a company that you were running. I don't know how to describe this. That's not a great way.
You didn't have debt to any customers.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. It was very easy to do from a technical standpoint. Emotionally, I mean, I was not ready to be acquired or give up the startup. Mm-hmm. I really loved what I was working on. I believed it was going to go somewhere. I had probably been the reason we turned down the initial Facebook acquisition offers. I really thought I'd never work for the man ever again. So having to accept that initially, I was like,
was Facebook the man in those days? 2004 is kind of.
It was at the time Facebook
had, for sure. Yeah.
They had just like
opened
recently
it up
beyond, opened it up beyond yeah. college. Yeah. And so I think there were about 25 million users on Facebook then, you know, compared to a billion or so now. So it was not quite the man, but it was an established corporation, you know, in which I was not the CEO. So that was not
that's bad.
That was not where I wanted to be. Right. But I had a lot of respect for Zuckerberg and for what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And
did they want the tech or did they just want your
No, they just it was an acqui-hire. We were actually their first ever acquisition, and we didn't know there was no acqui-hire term at the time. It wasn't a thing. So we too were confused. Why did they acquire us? We had no idea. It was all very bizarre actually. Initially, until we figured out what their intentions were, because we would go in there and do a demo of all of our stuff, which we were pretty excited about. And they were just they didn't seem interested in the demo at all. It was like, why do we even just demo that? It was just like, oh yeah, that's nice. So like, do you want to sign, you know, here's the offer. I'm like, really? Like, did you like the demo? Or it was all very puzzling. We've been going through this for years actually, because the same thing happened with venture capitalists where we would, you know, typically go in and say, here's what we want to build. You want to give us money? And they didn't seem to care. They just wanted to give us money because they had seen us in our names in the news, basically.
Yeah.
So it was not for a while clear to me why I was there. Right. And so
was it clear to Facebook? Did Facebook know what they wanted you to do? Or was it just like, we got to get these guys because they're good?
I think they knew they had to walk a fine. They didn't want to crush our dreams and tell us we don't care about what you've been doing for the last 2 years. We right. just want you to work on Facebook. So they didn't say that. Instead, they just kind of like gave us a desk and said, you know, figure something out. So initially, so it actually worked out in a very weird way for me because of the timing with regards to the iPhone. Mm-hmm. I had, just weeks earlier, I think my start day at Facebook was like June 27th or something. And the iPhone had just been released like 2 weeks earlier. I think it was June 15th. And I had completely stopped what I was doing on my startup the day I after waiting in line for the iPhone, and just gotten completely sidetracked with the idea that I would be able to write these web pages that would look like native apps. And there was I started a little JavaScript CSS framework called IUI, and I had gone to what was it called? There was this conference at Adobe's headquarters where everyone was trying to hack whatever we could out of the iPhone. Obviously, there was no SDK, and you know, this is the first month, so even the jailbreaking and other stuff like that hadn't been done yet.
Right. So when Steve said web apps were a sweet solution, were you like, hell yeah, that's a great that's
actually, great. I wasn't quite as pissed. I was not a Objective-C developer, so my heart wasn't broken by that.
Right.
I was fine with it, although I definitely, looking back, agree it was a shit sandwich type of a thing to say. Yeah. But for the first few months, so I had gotten so involved in developing these native looking web pages for iPhone that when I got to Facebook and I didn't really know what to do right away, I thought, why not just make a mobile iPhone-ish version of Facebook? Mm-hmm. So that was my first project there.
Good call. See, that's why they acquihire you.
I guess that's
just a great plan for them.
I guess it kind of worked out weirdly for the both of us, only because honestly, I don't know what I would have done there if it weren't for Apple. I felt for you, for my first 2 years there, actually, I felt more like I worked for Apple than Facebook because all I ever lived and thought about was what Apple was doing. And I hardly paid attention to what Facebook was doing. I would, you know, obviously I had to build a mobile version of the Facebook website, but I was, you know, less excited about the changes to the Facebook website and platform than I was what was going on in Cupertino.
They were content for your Apple bucket.
Exactly. It was an excuse to have fun, you know, on this incredible new platform. It was really, those first 2 years were really, really fun. First building the mobile website. And then, you know, the second they dropped the API, the iPhone SDK, I was all over that. And I was fortunate that because Facebook was a small company and their mobile efforts were relatively disorganized, I was free to work completely on my own, which I'd always done for a long time.
I was going to say, it's a bit of a theme for you.
Companies
just kind of hire a bunch of smart people and then just kind of let them run around.
I do like to run around.
Yeah. free range developer.
Yeah. Free range. So those first 2 years, I was able to do the app pretty much by myself. The only times I sought outside help was for the icons. That was really fun and also really, really stressful because the intersection of Facebook, you know, and the iPhone those were pretty much two of the most,
fast growing,
most popular,
it was the hottest app on the hottest platform.
Yeah. There were a lot of people really paying attention. So I remember, in particular, you know, as the platform grew and, you know, compared to now, the number of people using the app, it was like nothing. You know, years later now, you know, the number of people who have iPhones is huge. But even then, I remember, I think it was like after this, the second version, like I'd be on Twitter and there would just be people like calling me names, you know, where's this feature sucks or why haven't you released the new version yet?
Yeah.
A lot of people. Facebook has a lot of users. It'd be hard to find another.
It's app. Funny that they yell at you on Twitter, though. That's kind of.
I know, right? I know. They were yelling at me on Facebook, too, but in foreign languages mostly. So.
Yeah. So was that like, how did your name get attached to that? I mean, I know you did it, but I mean, at some point, why do people know to yell at you about that?
Because I made the mistake of talking publicly about what I was doing and Facebook didn't tell me not to, or they did, but I ignored them. So I would write on my blog, I would talk about, some of the major releases, what I had done, what I was planning to do. I would tweet about my plans or come up with a new feature.
I found a lot enlightening and it was a great read, but I guess, yeah, that does open you up to just getting screamed at by a bunch of people that are pissed off at like some minor bug or something.
It did. It was good and bad at the same time. And, you know, Facebook PR would yell at me occasionally and I kind of slowed down the pace of that stuff. But especially later on when Apple started complaining. But that was fun.
Oh, Apple gave you grief. Okay, that makes sense.
That was more after I started criticizing Apple.
Yeah. Okay, let's get into that. okay, first of all, so you're doing websites for the phone and then the SDK drops. You had been doing native programming quite like all of, you know, Gazool had like a bunch of native stuff on the back end. Your startup did have some native code, I guess, if you're going to do a web, like the apps are going to run natively too, right? For the startup stuff. I'm trying to ask, like, was getting into the SDK sort of coming back to writing native code? I suppose you've been doing it all the time.
I've been doing it back and forth. I sort of alternated between writing native code, C, C++, and, you know, JavaScript and higher languages, Python, things like that. So Objective-C was not much of a jump for me. It was pretty easy to get started. And I'd actually done a little bit of Objective-C when I worked at Netscape doing some of the Mac porting stuff. So
how'd you find it? Alien or just kind of yet another?
I grew to really like Objective-C. I really did. It has a lot in common with JavaScript, with the kind of semi-dynamic language stuff that you've got, introspection and it's a lot of fun stuff. I like Objective-C, and the platform was growing. Apple was really great about, you know, every new version they'd fix a pretty large number of the complaints I'd, you know, have about the previous version. So it was a great platform to work on. I kind of miss it.
So did you start the native Facebook thing entirely of your own volition, or did Facebook sort of give you the go ahead?
They gave me the go ahead. Yeah. I asked and they said yes, and that was it. So I just started working on it. The second the SDK dropped, I was working on it. And I worked on it for, I think, 2 or 3 months and did a lot of experiments. And it was hard, actually, to decide how much of Facebook to attempt to build into this little app.
Right.
Initially, Facebook, even to this day, is struggling with that. You see they have the all-in-one app, but then they have Messenger and Photos. And yep. I keep hearing rumors there, you know. Initially, my plan was to release 3 separate apps. There'd be a news feed kind of core app, and then there'd be a messaging and chat app, and then there'd be like a photo thing. Yeah. But we decided to just keep it simple in the first version. And
I think it makes sense these days to have them split out.
Yeah, there's definitely, especially for messaging, that app could stand on its own quite well. Yeah. So I worked on it for a while, and then when it came time for them to open the App Store and ship, you know, we had 1.0 on there, and it was actually pretty crappy, the first version. It didn't do a lot. I think people had much higher expectations for that first version, and I was really under a lot of stress to try to get the second version out and fill in all the missing features.
I think people don't understand how much of a pain in the ass it was to get those 1.0s out, because there wasn't that much lead time after the SDK dropped.
No, and yeah, it was like 3 months.
Nobody knew how to use it. Like, the platform was entirely new. Even Apple didn't know exactly what they were doing with it, right?
No. Apple was really, doing their best to teach people. They would even send people over from Cupertino to give us talks and try to teach us stuff. And I remember in particular, they sent a guy over and he gave us a list of all the things you shouldn't do, which I remember in particular laughing. He told us not to use, auto release. It's like, don't use auto release. It's like, it's too CPU intensive or something like that. And I was like, what? Like, don't use. I don't know. I know now you have the automatic reference counting, which I haven't used yet. But so the first version came out, and I remember in particular on launch day, MySpace, which still had a pulse at the time.
Yeah.
They had an app out too, and it did a lot more than the Facebook app. And I was just so embarrassed. And I was like, man, I've got to kill MySpace. And but they probably had, I think they probably like contracted out some firm to build their app. And
So was that a big rush for you? Cause that app was huge.
I didn't really understand how big it was going to be. In particular, I didn't understand how important it would become to Apple and how they would promote it. And they would be constantly bringing us over to Cupertino to talk to us about this and that. And I was even supposed to be in the keynote address at the Moscone Center when they opened the App Store, WWDC. But then I blew my they actually had me go through all the rehearsals and everything, and then kicked me out at the last minute, which was kind of a relief because I'm a terrible public speaker. I probably would have embarrassed myself on
that's a pretty big stage too. Like, you're gonna feel the heat there for sure. So what were the kind of hurdles that you faced? Because eventually you just give up on it. Not give up. Give up makes it feel like you got defeated, but you sort of threw the towel in out of frustration with the
got fed up, maybe.
Yeah. At least that's what you've said, is that sort of the review process and the App Store policies kind of rubbed you the wrong way.
Yeah. I think some people thought that maybe I had had some friction with Apple and they'd given Facebook a hard time or something. That definitely was not the case. They were great to us. They valued us. We were their most popular app, and I never had any problem with them at all. They didn't slow down our releases really or anything. But I was just, as a independent minded developer who intended to be an independent app developer someday, I was looking at how they were treating the smaller developers and apps constantly being pulled from the store or rejected for silly reasons. And I was just getting really mad. I started imagining myself, you know, post Facebook being in those people's shoes.
You had the soapbox to actually make a dent in it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I couldn't help myself. Looking back, I'm not sure I should have said a lot of things I said, but, definitely got a lot of people's attention because of the fact that I was the Facebook developer.
Was it the policy specifically, or sort of like the black box where you never really knew what policy you were going to hit up against?
That was a part of it. I think, I'm maybe not quite as extreme about it as I was then in my thinking, but the fact that there was any policy at all or any hurdles to jump through to get on the store was a bother for me. I was used to the web where you don't have anyone to approve or reject what you do. And I kind of wished, and I still think actually a better policy for them would be to do things, to remove things from the store that break the rules, but to not necessarily hold up releases. Like, let someone publish an app, and if it turns out it's doing something evil, then yank it.
Sort of like Google Play.
Is that how Google Play works?
Yeah, yeah. They tend to, I think they post everything, but if they get complaints, they'll pull it down.
Right. Yeah. I would prefer that at the very least, but, the fact that it was the fact that they're so non-communicative, they've gotten a little bit better, but as they were working out the policies, they were pretty vague, and that's pretty frustrating. I don't hear people complaining about it as much. You know, I haven't released an app or dealt with their platforms since 2009, so I don't even quite know how the policies have changed all that much. But I don't hear the bitching about it like I used to, so I assume that they're no longer making random decisions. Yeah.
I think they've ironed a lot of that out. And I think a lot of the lack of communication early on was because they didn't know. Then they were just kind of making it up until they could kind of, you know, sort of figure out what the actual policies were going to be and how they can apply them fairly.
In an incredibly non-committal manner at first.
Yeah, which I'm not defending it. I'm not saying it's good.
No, I think that they wanted to leave as much room as they could. You know, they didn't want to box themselves in and make a mistake.
Exactly, yeah. And as soon as they say something, they're kind of trapped to it. How do you feel about it now? Like, does it affect you as a user, let's say? Do you care about it anymore? Maybe it doesn't bother you.
I really don't think about it as much as I used to or at all. I just take for granted the situation. It's not going to change. And honestly, I kind of wish that the web as a platform would mature faster and so apps could just kind of go away. But that's, you know, that's not happening very rapidly. It may or may not happen in 10, 20 years.
So you're a dyed-in-the-wool web guy, right? Like, if every piece of software on your system besides the operating system was built with web tech, you'd be good with it?
I'm a realist. I mean, the web is suited for certain things and not for others. You know, people have tried to make everything web-based and like we were talking about web operating systems earlier. Yeah. That's kind of ridiculous. I think the web, because of the app situation, the web has had to really, people have had to really figure out what works well on the web and what doesn't. Games in particular, I wouldn't even waste my time writing games for the web, even though a lot of people still do. Media based stuff, that's where I get really irritated when people write apps for publishing type stuff. I understand there are some benefits to the magazine subscription model and things like that, but it's not quite as convenient to charge people money on the web. I understand that, but the browser is a great system for browsing reading things, and apps just aren't. I mean, they are if you stay within the app, but the whole promise of the internet is, you know, hopping from one place to another, and apps just totally break that. I just can't. It's real. I mean, some of these magazine based apps have really cool and interesting, from a programming design perspective, interesting UIs, but yeah. But I don't use them. I probably never will. I wouldn't recommend them to anyone. The browser's where it's at. But then there are places where apps are just, you know, utilities and things like that. You know, calendars, things like that. That I don't have a problem at all. So it really depends. I don't really think apps should go away. They both have a place.
Were you sort of, I mean, as much as you said people gave you a hard time when you were writing the Facebook app, when you left, it seems like every time there was a bug, people would flood Twitter or flood Facebook begging for you to come back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that was silly. I mean, people, the people who took over the app were very, very competent. I hate when I'd see a tweet mentioning my name saying, oh, there's this bug, Joe should have never left. Like, come on. Like, you know how many bugs were my fault that, like when I was in there? Like, really? That's probably gotten better since I left. But at least there are more than one people working on it now, I'll say that.
How was it for you open sourcing the 320 library?
Oh gosh, I was afraid you were going to ask about that. 320 was 320 was a questionable decision on my part. I mean, because the Facebook app was so huge and it had so many different components that I saw missing that I had to write that were missing from UIKit, I thought, you know, I've been an open source guy forever, so I just naturally open source whatever I can, and so I started piling separating all the potentially reusable stuff from the app into this framework, and I threw it up on GitHub. And I did not, there's nothing wrong with that, but the fact that Facebook was, again, so popular and people naturally gave this new framework a lot of credibility that it maybe didn't deserve because it was poorly documented. It had a lot of slop in there. I used categories liberally. Mm-hmm. So I polluted a lot of the Apple classes, and that caused people a lot of headaches. People would come to 320 because they want to use, for instance, maybe the photo browsing.
I was going to say, I think that's right? the big one, yeah. Because yeah, Apple still doesn't actually just have a drop-in control for that.
Exactly. They would come for one thing, and then they would get all this other crap that they'd have to link into their app and figure out all this stuff. And I got a lot of hate email from that. I get a lot of people who, you know, tell me they're glad that they love 320, blah, blah, blah. But an equal amount of people, I think, were frustrated by it and sent me hate mail and quit. You know,
I don't understand why people would send hate mail. If you don't like it, don't use it. I don't get it. Why?
That's true, but I think people, there's a certain promise when you release a framework, especially when it has implicitly the blessing of a large company.
Sure.
There's a certain expectation that's set. This is why I think 320 was a mistake on my part. There's a certain expectation of quality and of ease of integrating into your app, and that wasn't there. So I think for that reason, people felt kind of like duped. You know, like, oh, I heard there was this great component written by, you know, this big company and this well-known developer. It's surely going to be great. And then they had problems with it that they didn't anticipate. So if I had had the foresight to realize how many people were going to try and use it, I probably would have documented it better, and I would have stripped out a lot of the crap and maybe even split it into separate libraries so people can just have the thing they want.
Like it would have become its own product rather than being sort of part of the sauce that goes into making the actual Facebook app.
Right. Yeah. And actually it got to the point where I heard people who attended WWDC, like Apple engineers, would go up there and be like, don't use 320. It's terrible. So I don't know if they said it's terrible, but they said, don't use it. And I had to agree in the form that I released it. But yeah, it's okay. It's
well, the other thing is, because I think a lot of people, like inexperienced developers, would maybe just grab it and stick it in and not understand what the hell is going on.
That is definitely true. Yeah, there are a lot of new programmers or new Objective-C programmers coming into iOS, and they, for some reason, heard that 320 would make it easier for them to learn Objective-C. I have no idea why. It didn't do that at all. It made it easier to get a photo browser into your app, I guess, if you needed that.
Oh, well, live and learn.
Yeah.
So now you're gardening. What led to that decision?
Oh, well, I have a backyard now after years of renting, and nice. I loved my grandparents' garden when I was a kid, and so you know, when I bought this house and I had a nice piece of land in the back, I got really excited about, you know, growing some food back there. So it's nice. It's really nice having a place to go every day and walk around outside and, you know, get my hands in the soil, watch the plants grow year after year. I've got about 50 or 60 fruit trees that are, you know, slowly, wow. Okay. slowly moving towards maturity. And, you know, I try to eat as many vegetables as I can out of there. So it's a mental and physical sort of health part of my life now. It's a nice thing to have, especially after having lived in an apartment for basically my entire adult life until 2 years ago.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think when you've spent a chunk in your life going to Denny's at 1 a.m.
Yes, indeed.
Maybe this is the right thing for you to do. Yes, was there anything that led you to leave Facebook, or was it just you kind of burnt out a bit?
I was there for about 4 years. I actually quit Facebook once a year for 4 years and was talked into staying. I really, really, really wanted to be on my own, developing something independently. And Facebook made it really hard for me to leave because it was a really great place to be as an engineer, and they gave me total freedom. As much as I didn't want to work for a company, I really respected the people there. And so I stayed as long as I possibly could. And the fourth time I resigned, they accepted it without complaint. So that's what happened. But I mean, it would be hard to find a better place to work. I certainly didn't quit for not right. liking working there.
Do you ever get the itch? Or do you work on anything by yourself?
Oh yeah, for sure. I've worked on a number of things in the last 2 years that I think some of them are on GitHub, although I probably marked a lot of them private. I've got a number of projects going, and it's no sense talking about them because, you know, I don't know if I'm going to release them or when or what, but, oh yeah, I definitely still code. I still, do a lot of JavaScript, web-based stuff, server stuff generally in Node.js. And, yeah, I'm going to try to have fun with it.
Cool. Building a database for your pants.
Yes. And my baseball card collection. Yeah.
One of the things I found interesting is, as much as you rage quit, you know, the iPhone over the App Store, when the iPad was released, you were very enthusiastic about it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh gosh. I was dying for them to release a tablet. And I, you know, I love the iPad. You know, it's probably, I use the iPad about 5,000 times more than my iPhone and Mac combined. It's just, it's the best. So and it's kind of sad for me that I never got to write an app for it. It's a great tool.
Is that because it feels like a window into the internet, which is, you know, something that you've always wanted?
Yeah, it feels great just to lie down or sit down and use that thing. I think I spend the bulk of my computer time just reading stuff or listening to stuff or watching stuff, other than programming. You know, programming I do on my Mac, and everything else is just great for the iPad. I wouldn't even think about like browsing the web or watching videos on my Mac anymore. So yeah, I'd love to develop a tool for the iPad. I sort of am, but you know, save that for another time.
It's a gardening app.
No, actually, you know, people always joke about that. I would never even think about gardening technology. The garden is the opposite of the technology world that I spend way too much time in the house. So when I get out there, the last thing I want to be doing is running gardening apps.
That's cool. I like that. It's your little island, your escape.
Yeah.
That's great. I was going to say if there's anything you want to plug, but I don't know. Maybe are you selling fruit by the side of the road sometimes or what?
Not yet.
You should. That'd be kind of awesome.
Yeah. Someday. People are always asking me for stuff from my garden, and I hoard it.
One thing I was curious about, and I don't know if you have an opinion on this or not, is, you know, there's been a lot of debate about web apps versus native apps, but more specifically recently, things like the New York Times, where they have many different versions of the web app. They have they have the app, you know, the actual app itself, whether it's in Newsstand, whether it's not. You already said that you prefer looking at the web because, you know, you hit a link, you're still in the browser. You're not jumping between apps or jumping out to browsers. But is it interesting to you to watch all these big media companies and big properties kind of try to figure out the different platforms?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I'm shocked that they haven't figured it out yet. There's still experiments that to me look doomed from the beginning coming up all the time. You know, if you're the New York Times and, you know, you can maybe make a credible case that people will spend an hour reading your content and only your content. Okay. Maybe it makes sense, but, there are very few others where it even makes anything close to sense. Like I said, there's some pretty cool experiments. Gosh, just recently I was using, the one, by, The Loop magazine.
Yeah.
I guess that's on a new platform that some
guy, Glide.
Glide, yeah. That looked great. Really cool. But again, I'd probably never use it. You know, that those articles will do just fine in the browser. I don't know if they're being held for the app only or not, but I think in the future it just makes too much sense for stuff to be web based that in the media world that I think these apps eventually are just gonna be history.
The only interesting thing from a publisher's perspective is that people now search the app store the way they used to search the web. And if you're not in there, they won't find you. Like if someone doesn't search the web, they won't find the loop. But if they hear about it and they search in the app store, now there's something that they can find there that's, you know, loop based.
But wouldn't you think that people would, you know, the link sharing would move a lot faster than, you know, searching for a particular thing on the app store? You know, content moves a lot faster than, you know, the idea of searching for a specific publication.
I agree. I just think that there was a rush to get web properties. There's sort of been a rush to get app properties just because it was a place and it was popular and everyone needed a web page in the 90s. Now everyone feels like they need an app just to be in there with everyone else.
Yeah. I mean, I understand why people are doing it. I mean, I sure as hell would have done it if I was running a popular blog. When this all started up, definitely. I just think eventually I'd love to see the numbers on some of these magazine apps, how often they're downloaded or used compared to the web. But that's just my prediction. I just feel like that long term, all the publishers will just say, hey, this app is really cool, but you know, we're just getting much more engagement in the browser.
I can see that. I'm being quiet because I work on the magazine app from the one that Marco started and then sold to Glenn Fleischman.
So, oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So
I've been subscribed to the magazine probably since the first issue, and sadly, I hardly ever read it. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of things to read on my
devices. It's an app, or because it's like you just don't think to fire it up.
Yeah, I just don't think to fire it up. I generally start with, you know, a handful of sites and go from there. You know, my RSS newsreader or Twitter or Facebook or TechMeme or News Hacker News, you know, all these places I start. Yep. And if I don't find something via that flow, it's I never think, oh, let's sit down and read publication X on my iPad. Just never crosses my mind ever.
And there's so much stuff out there just following, even from just RSS or something, that like coming up dry in terms of stuff to read.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Like I have so many tabs open all over the place of things that I really actually want to read, and I don't have the time for it.
I have Read Later bankruptcy. I keep saving all these links. Now I save them to Apple's thing because it's built into everything, and I don't even want to look at how long the list is.
Yeah, like I use Instapaper quite a lot, and I almost never get to it because there's always something new to read, except when I get on a plane.
Yeah.
God, I've got all this good stuff to read. It's
me too. Me too. Yeah. They should call it the read never button. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Or airplane mode should actually launch. Read later.
Let's go right to Instapaper. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. And I feel pretty good about this. You where do we find you on Twitter?
At Joe Hewitt. JoeHewitt.com.
We can blame you for any screw ups in Facebook.
Oh, absolutely. I love being blamed for that.
Yeah. Cool.
There's a frame dropping in the physics of my chat heads that I'm just mad about.
Yeah. I'm sorry about that. That code had been 3 years after I quit, but you know, somehow it's still my fault.
And your gardening site?
Oh, the, There is no gardening site. There's just my blog, joehewitt.com.
Perfect.
Where I have one gardening article posted.
I thought it was once a year, but it might just be because it only been updated this year.
It's been roughly once a year. Yeah, I need to start blogging more often.
Nice. Oh, thank you so much, Joe.
Thank you, guys. Great talking to you.